Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Well, I guess I should go ahead and say this right here at the top. You're listening to my final episode of Southbound. You might know that NPR's federal funding was eliminated by Congress. Member stations across the country, including WFAE, are facing budget cuts. I chose to take a buyout from WFAE as part of offsetting those cuts and also to move back to my roots as a full-time writer. We are parting on good terms, but I'm going to miss the hell out of doing this podcast. Over the past 7.5 years, if my math is correct, I've interviewed 173 people for Southbound. Some of them were famous at the time, such as race car driver Dale Earnhardt Jr. and singer Anthony Hamilton. Others became famous later. The Kentucky poet Ada Lee Mung became America's Poet Laureate. The Tennessee comedian Nate Bargatze now sells out arenas all over the country. And still others aren't as well known, but had their own compelling stories. I think about L.B. Prevett, fighting for LGBTQ rights up in Wilkes County, North Carolina. Or Rob Geip, who brings together regular folks from the hollers of Kentucky to create plays about their lives in Appalachia. I wanted Southbound to be a lot of things, but mainly I wanted it to bring forth the voices of people who love the South, understand its deep and pervasive flaws, and have decided to stick around and try to make it better. I think we've done that, and I hope you've been able to draw something meaningful from these conversations. If you're ever interested in going back into the archive, every episode is available at WFAE.org. Just click on the Podcast and Columns tab, and you'll find Southbound there. For this final episode, I'm on the other side of the mic. WFAE Executive Editor Eli Portillo interviewed me about how Southbound started, what it's like to do journalism in these difficult times, and why it still matters, among other things. It was a privilege to talk to Eli, and it's been a privilege to have this space for this time. Here's our conversation.
Well, Tommy, we've kind of orbited around each other in Charlotte journalism in different places since I got here in 2009. And I was a young reporter at the Charlotte Observer, and you were already a household name, I think it's fair to say.
Already an old reporter at the...
Well, yeah, I mean, you were seasoned already, and I was raw. Tell me a little about your path to Charlotte specifically, and how you ended up as a local columnist, someone who's really a voice of a community.
Sure. So I finished up at the University of Georgia in 1986. And then...
So I got to stop you there because we were talking about age. I was born in 1986, so that's great.
I really appreciate you telling me that, Eli. That makes me feel so good. So out of college in 86, from 86 to 89, I worked my first job as a newspaper reporter in Augusta, Georgia. And then in 1989, got hired by The Observer to work in its bureaus. The Observer used to have a bunch of bureaus in all the counties surrounding Charlotte. I was a one-person office in Lancaster, South Carolina. Worked there for a while. Was actually at The Observer for about 3 years. Left briefly just for a few months. Came back in the beginning of 93. Was the music writer from 93 to 97. And then during 1997, 96, 97, a couple of the columnists that had been working for the paper had left, and they were looking for somebody new. And they basically held a tryout among several people who worked for the paper at the time, and also some people who didn't work for the paper who tried out from the outside. And I ended up being lucky enough to get one of those slots. And so I started working as the columnist in 1997 and did that until I left the paper in 2012.
And then you worked a few other places, Did some freelance and ended up at WFAE in 2017. Am I right about that?
That's right. I was a freelancer mostly from 2012 to 2017. During that time is when podcasts started to become a much bigger deal. And I was listening to them. I was enjoying them. And I started thinking about, you know, what would I do if I ever wanted to do a podcast? I'd also been writing a lot of magazine features and things like that during that time. You know, part of what you do in that is you get a transcript of the interviews. And so I would have these long interviews with people that would be really fascinating to me. And I'd get the printout and I'd read them. And I kind of found myself wishing, man, I wish we could just like publish the transcripts of the interviews because this is some really good stuff here. You know, in a sense, that's what an interview podcast is. And so I started thinking about what would I want to do if I did a podcast. And the thing that I kept coming back to is, you know, I'm a lifelong Southerner, somebody who loves this place, but also, you know, has a lot of qualms about it and a lot of wish we did a lot of things better. The idea I had was to talk to interesting Southerners about those same things, about what do they love about the South and how did it shape them the way they do whatever it is they do. For a while, I thought I would just do it myself, you know, self-publish it. But at some point, I talked to Greg Collard, who used to be the news director here at WFAE, pitched him that idea, and he said, you know, why don't you come talk to us about it and maybe do some samples? And so I did a few sort of podcasts as a freelancer for them, and eventually they decided they wanted to bring me on full-time.
You know, if you stay in this business long enough, you write thousands and thousands of articles and podcasts and features and columns and millions of tweets and who knows what else. I know me personally, I've forgotten most of what I've done except for the most memorable things, but those memorable ones really tend to stick with you. What really sticks with you out of the stories you've gotten to tell in Charlotte, out of your weekly commentaries here at WFAE, people you've talked to on Southbound, stories you've written at The Observer? At this point in your career, looking back, what still sticks on you?
Well, I'll tell you about my favorite Southbound episode first. It was kind of early on. It was maybe in the first dozen or so episodes. I interviewed this guy, Andre Leon Talley, who is he's passed away now, but he was an icon in the fashion world. He was, I think, editor of Vogue magazine at one point. He grew up in Durham in poverty and was a real self-made man, just made his way into the fashion world. He knew Andy Warhol. He danced at Studio 54 with Diana Ross. And this big, tall, like 6'6", kind of a behemoth of a guy. And so I ended up interviewing him when he came to Charlotte. He curated an exhibit of Oscar de la Renta's work at the Mint Museum. The first couple of months that I did this podcast, my joke was, they never let me touch the knobs. Like, I couldn't play with any of the equipment. And so I always had somebody around to work the recorder or whatever. And this was a field recording. And so my friend Nick Della Canal, who was one of the producers in the early episodes of the show, came with me to do the recording. And so we went to the Mint and we waited in another room while Andre was finishing up a photo shoot. And this photo shoot apparently did not go well because we could hear Andre like cursing and yelling from, you know, the other side of the wall. And Nick and I are looking at each other like, oh man, this is not going to go well, right? And so Andre finally comes in, he kind of swoops into the room, looks at me like, who are you? And I'm like, well, I'm the guy from the radio station to do an interview with you. He's like, fine, let's do the interview, you know? And he's kind of snooty and he's kind of off-putting at first. But after a while, when we sit down and talk for a little while, he kind of gets into a groove and it's comfortable and we're having a good interview. I always grew up hearing from really good reporters, always ask the question that you're afraid to ask. And so Andre, at that time, was a very big man. And he always wore these like robes and caftans, capes, these sort of big flowing things that didn't, I'm sure, weren't form-fitting, right? And so I like got up my courage and asked the question I wanted to ask. And I said, Andre, have you ever heard of Ric Flair? And he's like, Ric Flair, who is that? And I'm like, he's a professional wrestler. And I'm like, and he's like, a professional wrestler. And for the first and only time in my life, somebody said to me, talk to the hand. I don't want to talk about professional wrestlers. And I was like, no. Andre, the reason I wanted to ask you about Ric Flair is that Ric Flair is known for his beautiful robes. And his robes, when I saw you, it reminded me of him. And he went, huh. He went, you know, I met Andre the Giant one time because I'm Andre. They wanted me to meet the other Andre. And he started off on a story about that, and it was fine. And I just remember, like, the look in his eye when I mentioned Ric Flair to him, just thinking he was going to come across. Yeah, we were sitting in, like, two little folding chairs, like, 3 feet from each other. I just thought he was going to come across the space at me, and my 12th episode of Southbound would be the last one because I'd be beaten to a pulp by Andre Leon Talley. So that's that in terms of Southbound, that's one that really sticks with me.
And you talked to a lot of people who I think exemplify many of the contradictions of the South. And Andre Leon Talley is an example of that. I think you tend to find people who don't fit into a single stereotypical box. And this is a region that's often stereotyped. Am I on the right track there? Is that something that attracts you to people who might be interesting subjects and people you look to speak with?
You know, there are podcasts you do with kind of famous people that are going to draw people no matter what. But I always wanted to do, as a part of the mix, people who weren't so famous but were doing really interesting work. And early on, I remember one of the people I interviewed was a guy named Josh Burford, who was an LGBTQ historian over in Alabama. And he just told all these incredible stories about people in the, you know, way back in the 30s and 40s who stood up for LGBTQ rights in places that were very much not amenable to those things. The people who paid lots of prices for standing up like that. And so Josh was somebody who and is still doing really amazing work, kind of showing us our hidden history in a way. And it's a history that if you think about the South in a stereotypical way, you might not think about a lot because you think about this as being a place that can be very hostile to gay and lesbian people. And it is in a lot of ways. But there are a lot of people who are LGBTQ, who are people of color, who are women, you know, minorities who are not part of the sort of Southern typical majority, who are doing incredible things here and have chosen to stay, even though their lives might be easier elsewhere, because they, like me, they love so much about the South, they care so much about the South, and they want to make it better.
Talk a little bit about your connection to place.
Sure.
Because I think you've lived in Charlotte now, if my math is right, longer than anywhere else. But you're from Georgia and come from, I think, a place that is different from Charlotte, smaller, based on my reading of your writing, more rural, maybe a little more country. Charlotte, I think, is a city where it's very easy to move to and very hard to feel like home in my experience. After all this time in Charlotte, is Charlotte home for you? Or when you think home, do you still think somewhere else?
I have to say, when I think of home, I think of Georgia first. But as you can tell, I'm still here in Charlotte. So I'm deeply rooted in Charlotte now as well. And you're right about it, them being very different. So where I grew up on the coast of Georgia, a small town, 5,000 people, moved to a slightly larger town of about 30,000 people down there. The makeup of the place was very different. Where I grew up was about 50-50 black and white and almost nobody else. There was one Asian girl in my high school. Her family owned the Chinese restaurant in town. You know, that sort of thing. There were very few Latinos or any other ethnic group where I grew up except black and white. So when I eventually made my way to Charlotte, one of the things I think that marks how you think of Charlotte is where you're coming from. So I came from a much smaller place. And so Charlotte felt then like a huge city to me. I'd lived in Atlanta briefly, but I'd never really spent time in a city like I spent time in Charlotte. And so the idea that you could, things were open all night long, or that you could do something really fun and interesting on like a Tuesday afternoon, you know, all those things were kind of new to me. But there are a lot of people who move here from New York or Chicago or somewhere, and Charlotte feels really parochial to them. It feels like a small town. So I think it's so much about the context and where you're coming from. I'm still sort of feel like Charlotte still feels kind of big to me, even though I know my way around it really well now. There's still parts of Charlotte, I've been here almost 40 years now, that I haven't really explored well and don't know very well. Charlotte still feels pretty big, even though in my neighborhood and amongst my friends, that feels like a small town. And that feels like home to me, like the people that I've spent a lot of time with here. And so I kind of lucked out and that I get to feel a little bit of both when I'm here. And that's, I'm sure, one reason I've stayed.
As you've been a writer in Charlotte for decades and you've written a column and sports stories and a podcast and a radio audio commentary, I feel like your writing has moved towards more personal stories and more openness about yourself. And I'm thinking here of your first book, Elephant in the Room, which was very personal to stories like, I believe it was the Atlantic article you wrote about how you cried when your dog died, but not when your mother did. And, you know, those, I think, those can be tough in some ways to write, but also in some ways, depending on your state of mind, in my experience, they can be easier to write if you're just ready to kind of let yourself flow out there. What's that journey been like for you? And what's it been like moving from, in some ways, telling other people's stories to still doing that, but also telling more of your own story?
First of all, I want to make clear, I did not love my dog more than I love my mom. It's just that, and part of what I tried to write in that piece was how you feel about an animal you love catches you in a different way. And you don't have that ability to communicate with that creature, how you feel about him. You don't get to like settle things the way that I was able to talk it out with my mom and that sort of thing. But that is a facet of that personal stuff you're talking about. And I think, you know, when you start out, I think it's healthy for young writers not to write about themselves much. You want to learn other human experiences and see how they fit in with yours and see where the stuff you're feeling might be something that's universal or whether it's something that's, you know, more specific just to you. And so I spent most of my early career, in fact, many, many years writing about the stuff that wasn't about me at all and learning about other people's lives. And that was really good for me. It taught me so much about, not just about being a storyteller, but about being a person.
I think that's one valuable part of what newspapers used to do is pay 21-year-olds to write about other people.
Yes.
Because I know when I was a young reporter, that really pushed me to get out and talk to other people. And if I didn't have that, I probably would have fallen into, you know, the blogging, narcissism, everything about me, my diary is the most interesting thing in the world that you find in a lot of stereotypical young writers who haven't seen anything. But in some way, newspapers were almost a public service thing, like, hey, we're going to pay young writers to write about things besides themselves and their own feelings for a while.
Yeah, I think also a lot of people who get into our field are personal introverts, but professional extroverts. Like, we're naturally introverted, but we realize that it's good and healthy for us to get out and talk to other people. And so we've kind of gravitated to these jobs that require us to do that. And so I think, you know, given a normal evening, I'd just as soon sit home and read a book than go out and talk to other people and socialize. But I know it's good for me to get out and socialize. And so journalism gave me a reason and gave me assignments to get out and do that sort of thing. And so it sort of built all the storytelling skills that I needed when it came time to tell my own story. You know, you mentioned Elf in the Room, which was my memoir about being overweight in a country, in a world that makes it very difficult to be that. You know, I knew for years that I should tell that story, but it took a lot of time for me to finally kind of work up the courage and sort of feel like I was ready as a storyteller to write it. I'd been a professional journalist for almost 30 years before I sat down to write that book. All that time writing about other people was extremely useful to me when it came time to sit down and write my own story. And I've used that, all those skills, in writing about other things, like when my dog passed away, or when family members pass away, or just other things that have happened in my life that I write about in my newsletter and other places, or sometimes for the radio. You know, all those things now are easier to write because I have all that experience of writing about others.
Let's see. Looking at what you've done, I think you've got newspapers, podcast, audio commentary, Substack newsletter, magazine pieces, online only web startup, news sites. I know. So you've done pretty much every genre very close to.
Covered the waterfront, I think. Yeah. Dabbled in a little bit of everything. One thing I tell young journalists, you know, and I know this is an incredibly difficult time, especially for young people kind of getting into this business. But one thing I tell them is that your skills are transferable. If you get good at telling stories, or if you get good at gathering information, there are lots of places where those skills are valuable. You know, my career has been an example. I've been able to go from kind of one genre to another, and to do similar things, but just in different formats. And I hope, you know, for whatever working job I have left, that I'll be able to kind of hop, skip, and jump to the next thing. But the skills are all the same. The skills are talking to people. The skills are gathering information and turning those into stories. I feel like if you can do that, you can get work in a lot of places.
What do you like, not like, miss about different genres you've worked in? I mean, I know for me personally, I still miss column inches and having the restraint of writing something in a nice 20-inch story, getting it tight like that. I was actually talking with some younger folks recently, and I asked them if they were familiar with inches as a length of measuring a story. And, you know, these were like college journalists, and they were not familiar with the concept. And I was like, man, That's something that's just totally vanished. I miss column inches.
There's that great term that we used to use called widows. Remember widows? Mm-hmm. If you had a paragraph, if the piece was like two lines too long, you would go back and look for a paragraph that bled over like two words in the next line. You would trim that paragraph to save yourself a line. That was called cutting the widows.
Yeah, I remember Liz Chandler sitting there and doing that with my stories when I got hired at The Observer.
Yeah. Yeah, widows are a thing of the past now. I'll tell you what I miss. I miss at The Observer, you know, in its heyday, we had like 250, 260 people in the newsroom, and you go into work every day and there'd be dozens and dozens of people who were there. Obviously other people out in the field or whatever. but there'd be all this chatter, this kind of white noise going on. There was always somebody to talk to, always somebody to bounce ideas off of. But what was amazing about it to me was when something big happened, when there was some disaster or some huge story or some breaking news, it was like watching, you know, those Transformer movies when the cars all turn into this incredible creature, like a snap of a finger, and the newsroom would just like fall into place, and all these people would grab their stuff and start running out the door, and editors would start, you know, saying, you do this, and you do this, and you do this. Somebody would like tear up the front page because they knew it was going to be different the next day. And that moment of this newsroom just sort of transforming into this incredible, like, newsmaking machine, I miss that a lot. Obviously, as the newspaper shrank, that diminished that a lot. And then I think COVID was sort of a death knell for newsrooms in general in a lot of ways because people quit coming. I know you've tried to bring some of that back to WFAE with limited success because everybody's having limited success.
It's hard. Yeah. I mean, once you get into the mode of doing things remotely, it's really hard to switch back the other way. And it's one of those collective action problems that requires everyone to act. If a few people don't act, the whole thing kind of falls apart.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, that's one thing I really miss. But, you know, I'll miss lots of stuff about this podcast too. I'll miss like finally getting a handle on the audio gear and kind of knowing what I'm doing and being able to edit a piece of audio, you know. I don't know if I'll ever need that skill again, but by golly, I have it if I need it. And so all this stuff, and then obviously along the way, at every stop, every place I've had, I've gathered another few friends. So there are people from this job that I will always spend time with and hang out with and talk to afterwards, the same at every place I've ever been. And so that, to me, is sort of the real human residue you kind of accumulate along the way, is all these people who are now part of your life who might not have been had you not been at that place at that time. And that's the real, you know, great part of it.
So you've been a voice of Charlotte for a long time, I think a written voice, and then as you'd moved more into audio, a vocal voice. I guess that's repetitive. But you obviously have a unique voice, a voice that sounds different than a lot of voices people are used to hearing on audio. For people who aren't familiar, what's the story behind how your voice sounds and how have you adapted to that in the audio world?
So in 1993, I was diagnosed with throat cancer. There was no particular reason for it. As my doctor said at the time, you know, there's like 50% this, 40% this, 10% this, and then there's like other. And I was other. And so I ended up having surgery to take out part of my voice box. It had left me with this voice that I've had ever since. It's gotten slightly better over the years, but at some point it kind of is what it is. And so I have this real breathy, raspy voice. I didn't know at the time that I had the surgery if I would have any voice at all. And I was really worried after they did the surgery whether kind of my career as a reporter would be doomed, because how can you do this if you can't talk to people? But obviously managed to come out of it with a voice. And then when 24 years later or so, when I kind of pitched the idea for a podcast, I pretty much assumed I wouldn't get laughed at, but I would get eyebrows raised because nobody who sounded like me was on the radio, except one case, and that was NPR, Diane Rehm, who had a different issue than I had, but she definitely did not have a typical, you know, NPR voice. You know, incredibly grateful to WFAE for giving somebody with my voice a spot on the radio and giving me time every week to be on there. I think after a while, listeners get used to it and it's not as big an issue anymore. When I first came on the air, I would get some comments, or the station would get some comments, God, that guy has a weird voice, you know. I hope he gets better soon or whatever. I think everybody always thinks I have a cold. So when I was writing for the paper, when I was a columnist, my picture would be in the paper all the time. And so I'd have people come up to me on the street and say, oh, you're that dude from the paper. And now when I speak in public, when I'm like at the grocery store checking out, I'll check out and like the clerk will go, wait, are you that dude from the radio? And I'm like, yeah, that's me. And they're like, oh, I love your voice, whatever. And so that shift has been fascinating to me. But what it says to me is that people pay attention. You know, they're listening for that voice on the radio now. And when they hear it, they're like, oh, that's that guy. They put a face to it in a way that they used to put a voice to the face they saw in the newspaper. And so those interactions are always like delightful to me.
You're stepping away from WFAE at a time, obviously, when WFAE is struggling financially, having big challenges between the loss of federal funding and ongoing issues with philanthropic support, et cetera. I mean, I feel like the industry's been in crisis since I've been in it, the new local news industry especially. But it's fair to say the most fraught time in American media in a very long time. What are your thoughts on the state of the industry now, the news industry, and I guess tied into that, the state of democracy, because American democracy is so closely tied to the media. But what do you think about the state of things as you're stepping away?
First of all, I think you're absolutely correct that the state of the media and the state of democracy are tied together. It's kind of a cliche in our business to say this, but it's still true. There has never been a better time for bad guys to thrive because there are simply fewer eyeballs watching them, paying attention, digging through documents, covering meetings, and paying attention to what the bad guys are doing. And I think that's reflected in the leadership of our country, the leadership of our states, down to local government in many, many places. So that's something that no matter what you think about the bias of the press, no matter what you think about how other industries are suffering too, that's something that should just be in the front of your mind as an American citizen. The loss of strength that the media has undergone in the last at least 15 to 20 years is a crisis for everybody. And I don't know where we go from here. You know, I keep hoping, and everybody keeps hoping, we're walking toward a bridge that will lead us to some happier, more fruitful, more lucrative other side. We keep thinking that, you know, at one point, everybody thought podcasts were it. And I think podcasts have become incredibly lucrative for a few people. You know, Joe Rogan's making a ton of money off a podcast, but the average podcast is not. They always talk about pivoting to video, you know.
I remember that phrase.
Well, I think we're back into like a second round of that in a lot of ways. There are video people who are making a ton of money in video, but the average journalist and the average journalistic enterprise doing that is not. What we've lost, and this what's happening at WFAE and NPR is just the latest iteration of that, is that all the funding, all the business sources that held this together for decades, centuries even, in the newspaper business have just completely eroded. You know, newspapers used to be able to do what they did and to fund all these big staffs because they sold so much advertising. And now the only places that sell a ton of advertising are like Google and Facebook and those places. And they have a death grip on the information flow in this country. They get to choose basically what news gets seen and what news doesn't. They don't want a lot of the thing that we think of as traditional news sources, you know, clogging up their feeds. It's incredibly difficult to make a financial go of it as a journalist or as journalism in the bigger institutional sense. One reason that FAE was able to stave this off for as long as they did was that we are so much supported by our listeners in a direct way, in a way that subscriptions really didn't support the newspaper business. It was just a small part of the revenue from the newspaper business.
Yeah, maybe paid for the distribution.
Right. It's a huge part of the public radio business. And so we have to lean even harder than usual now on our listeners while we wait and hope that there are other sources of revenue that either will come back to us or stuff that we don't even know is out there yet. I don't put rose-colored glasses on this. It's a really difficult time. But I also think it's maybe the most important time since, like, the revolution that we keep our media strong. Some days I feel like we're the only thing, like, holding this stuff together. The stories that we have managed to do, the watchdog journalism that has managed to be out there, the stories that we have managed to break is kind of what's holding this whole enterprise together. We have to keep doing that.
Well, speaking of building new models and figuring things out, what's next for you? Where are you headed next?
Well, I have this one thing already in place, which is a newsletter called The Writing Shed. It's on Substack. You can find it by searching for my name and The Writing Shed, or my name and Substack. It's easy to find. The model that I have for it right now is sort of a pay-as-you-want-to model. It's sort of the old patronage system that, like, painters used to have, you know? So to sign up for the newsletter is free. But if you choose to support my work by throwing me a few bucks, you know, $5 a month, $50 a year, whatever you want, you could do that. And I'm hoping that as I take time away from WFAE, I'll be able to devote more time to this newsletter and want to build it into something that is a good business. Maybe not enough to, like, pay all the bills, but enough to pay some of the bills and enough to be something that the community that I build around it feels is worthwhile and useful and worth their time and money. You know, I think that's one thing that all of us as kind of independent journalists have to do, is sort of build a community for ourselves, whether it's through some sort of expertise in a subject or topic area, or just people like you as a storyteller, or whatever that is. You have to kind of build this community of people who want to follow you around. And so that's what I'm trying to do with this newsletter. Beyond that, I think I am looking forward to writing more books. I have 3 or 4 irons in the fire on that right now that I'm not really ready to talk about in any detailed way, because I want there to be contracts and things I can announce and that sort of thing. But I definitely have several ideas floating out there that I want to pursue. I've written 2 books, and they've done well enough that publishers are interested in me doing another one, so I'm looking forward to doing that. And then in between, I will probably do some magazine pieces, do some other kinds of writing. You know, like you said, there's a lot of different venues out there to do writing now. And I look forward to going back to some of the places that I've worked in the past and maybe trying out some new places in the future and just seeing how it all comes together. You know, I'm kind of building what I hope becomes a viable way to make a living. You know, I have confidence in my abilities. And every time I've tried to do this before, I've been able to make it work. So I'm giving it one more shot.
Well, I am going to just go ahead and predict that whatever you do, it will be awesome. And I know that we will be pre-ordering your next book. I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess Bodice Ripper set at the Westminster Dog Show.
Boy, that's a great idea. I'll tell you that. If I don't write it, somebody should.
There you go. Well, Tommy, we will miss having you on the air every Monday. We will miss your voice, but we know that you will not be absent from Charlotte and from the writing and reading that sustains so many folks in this community with something to look forward to. So it's been a privilege having you. It's been an honor for me to edit you. Very rarely do you require much more than a few grammar tweaks, and we really wish you all the best.
Thank you, Eli, and thanks to everyone who's listened all this time. You know, this podcast has been going on almost 8 years now. I've heard from so many people from, honestly, not just Charlotte in the South, but literally all over the world. Doing radio, I've found, can be incredibly lonely because you're speaking kind of out into the void. But it's also this amazingly intimate thing where you can imagine you're talking just to one other person out there. And to do this show where usually I am just talking to one other person, but to know that that is going out and that somebody in Charlotte or somebody in Birmingham or somebody in Sacramento or somebody in Budapest is listening to that and getting something out of it and maybe feeling some pangs of homesickness or whatever they might be feeling from listening to it. That's an incredible privilege that I've had, and I'll miss it dearly. I'd like to thank a few folks here at the end. Joni Deutsch showed me how to make a podcast and was my editor back at the beginning. Nick Della Canal produced a bunch of those early episodes. Greg Collard, Lisa Wharf, Eli Portillo, Jen Lang, and many others along the way have edited episodes, posted them on social media, and otherwise helped make Southbound better in countless ways. Joe O'Connor gave me my shot here at WFAE, and Judon Marshall has been an incredible and supportive boss. Joby Sprinkle is my first call when I can't figure out how to use my gear. And if he can't fix it, he always knows who can. Thanks to every guest who agreed to sit down and talk to me. Our conversations routinely went an hour or more, a lot of time in these short Twitch days. As with most conversations, the longer they went, the better they got. Most of all, thanks again to all of you who have listened over the years. You gave me precious things, your time and attention, and I've tried to never take that for granted. The theme song of Southbound comes from a Charlotte musician named Joshua Lee Turner. It's a guitar loop he gave Nick years ago to possibly use on the radio sometime. I thought about it not long ago when Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys died. Brian's greatest song, God Only Knows, ends with a long fading loop on the chorus. And Brian Wilson said he wanted it to sound eternal, as if you lived in a world where the song never ended. In one sense, Southbound comes to a close with this episode. But as long as it's out there, as long as you can still hear it, it's eternal. The way a conversation feels when you never want it to end. Like a long fading loop.